Yes, okay. Good morning, colleagues. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing. Today, the 10th of June, we have a few announcements and we have a topic for you as well. Before we get to our colleague who is joining us from Port Sudan to this, speak to the situation in Sudan, we'll immediately go to Isabel from ILO to give you an announcement on the International Labor Conference, and then we have other announcements after Port Sudan. So over to Isabel.
Thank you. Just a quick update on the second week of the International Labor Conference. Discussions continue on a new convention and recommendation on biological hazards, with adoption expected by the end of the week. The discussions are still ongoing on the standard setting committee on decent work on the platform in the platform economy. We are planning a briefing with the ILO leads on both topics on Friday. We will give you more information. Also next Thursday, so in 2 days, the Global Coalition for Social Justice will hold its annual forum. Established in 2023, the coalition unites over 350 partners committed to advance concrete action for social justice. Luis Abinader, President of the Dominican Republic, will open the forum. He will give the keynote speech alongside the coalition's coordination group members, Gilbert Ongbo, the ILO Director General, Luis Marinho, representing the government of Brazil, and Vice Chair Luc Triangle, ITCU General Secretary, and Roberto Suarez, IOE Secretary General. The sections explore six critical topics: promoting living wages, responsible business conduct, just transitions through social dialogue, advancing a human rights economy, empowering youth, harnessing artificial intelligence for social development. The sessions bring together over 20 ministers from all regions, alongside heads of international organizations. All the information is on the ILO website, and you can follow all the panels, all the discussions on ILO Live. And last but not least, two delegations have expressed their availability for media interviews, the delegations of Malaysia and the delegation of Panama. So if you're interested, please email us at newsroom@ilo.org, and we will connect you with their representatives. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Isabel. Questions for Isabel? No, I don't see. I think you were very comprehensive, very thorough. So thank you very much for that, and good luck with the remaining bits of the conference there. Okay, as mentioned, we're going to now turn to our colleague who's joining us from Port Sudan, Laurent Bouquera, who is the World Food Program's country director in Sudan, who again is connecting from Port Sudan. And thank you very much, sir, for doing this briefing with us here. So over to you, and then we'll go afterwards for questions. So over to you, Mr. Bouquera.
Well, thank you. I hope you all can hear me well.
Very well.
Thank you very much. So I've just returned from Khartoum State in Sudan. This is where we have opened a new office in Omdurman. For us, this marks a very key milestone in reestablishing our presence closer to the communities we served, and also reaffirm WFP commitment to deliver. The needs are immense. We saw widespread destruction, limited access to water, healthcare, and electricity, and a cholera outbreak. In parts of the city, life is returning, but many neighborhoods remain abandoned, such as a ghost city. Over the past 6 months, WFP scaled up assistance, and we are now reaching nearly 1 million Sudanese in Khartoum with food and nutrition support. This momentum must continue. Several areas in the south are at risk of famine. Sudanese communities have been on the front lines, hosting the displaced, but they are now at a breaking point. With returns expected to heavily damage areas like Khartoum, pressure on overstretched resources will intensify. We are deeply concerned, and meeting the basic needs, especially food, will be critical and is urgent. Urgent action is needed to restore basic services and accelerate recovery through coordinated efforts with local authorities, national NGOs, UN agencies, and humanitarian partners at large. At the same time, funding shortfalls are already disrupting some of the assistance we are providing in Khartoum, Blue Nile, Al Jazeera, and Sennar states. our rations and the oil and the pulses in the food basket had to be removed due to lack of resources. Without new funding in the immediate months, further severe reduction in assistance will have to be implemented. In Khartoum, life-saving nutritional supplements for young children and pregnant and nursing mothers are out of reach, not because of access constraints, but due at the moment to a lack of resources. Without urgent support, we will not be able to deliver the full package that Sudanese need as they return to Khartoum. WFP has a long-standing presence in Sudan, built over 6 decades of operations. As we scale up our efforts and address urgent food needs, we are also laying the foundations for long-term recovery, expanding cash assistance to revitalize local markets, and supporting bakeries and small business in their reopening. There is much we can do and are doing right now. WFP is now reaching 4 million people a month across Sudan. This is nearly 4 times more than at the start of 2024. As access has expanded, including in previously unreachable areas like Khartoum, we have rapidly scaled up our operation to meet increasing needs. We are aiming to reach 7 million people on a monthly basis, prioritizing those facing famine or other areas are at extreme risks, such as Darfur, Kordofan, Al Jazeera, and Khartoum states. With sustained support, we can do even more. Progress remains fragile. The rainy season is now starting, compounding an already dire situation. At the same time, indiscriminate and unacceptable attacks on humanitarian personnel and operation are escalating, including last week's attack on WFP UNICEF convoy just hours before reaching a besieged Al-Fashir in North Darfur. The convoy was at about 80 kilometers from the city. The convoy came under attack in Al-Kuma, resulting in a tragic loss of 5 humanitarian personnel and injuries to others. In April, 8 workers were killed during a major escalation of fighting in Zamzam, also around Al-Fashir. These attacks must stop immediately. While we can't thank donor partners enough for their support to humanitarian and resilience activity, needs at the moment are outpacing the funding that we receive. Despite generous contribution from our donor partners, we are running short of over $500 million for our emergency food and cash assistance alone for the coming 6 months. The international community must act now by stepping up funding to stop famine in the hardest hit area and to invest in Sudan's recovery. We must also demand respect for the safety and the protection of the Sudanese people and aid workers. This is the moment we stand with the Sudanese people as they rebuild their lives, communities, and hope that after 2 years of devastating conflict, we see a light at the end of the tunnel. We demand respect and safety for the population and humanitarian workers. Above all, the only solution, as we know, is peace. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Laurent. And naturally, the Secretary General echoes those very important messages, a call for peace, cessation of hostilities, and of course, the end of these horrific attacks in the flow of aid to those most desperately in need. So let's start off with questions in the room. Olivia from Reuters has a question for you.
Thank you very much, Laurent, for this. I have 3 questions, please. You've now got access to Khartoum, but have you had any access issues within the city itself, or have you been able to get to most areas? And I just want to check, in terms of the situation regarding famine, you're saying some areas in the south are at risk of famine. I just wanted to check, do you mean in southern parts of the city, or you mean in Sudan itself? And linked to that question, has the opening up of access there revealed anything in terms of the depth of hunger? And do you think any parts of Khartoum may now qualify as being in a famine state? And just finally, you said that you face a funding shortfall of about $500 million. In April, that figure was just shy of $700 million. So does that indicate you've had some funding through and maybe things are not as bad as you were expecting? Because I know you're talking about rations having to be declined, etc. So yes, those are the three questions. Thank you.
Back
Do
to
I
you.
Need to take?
Yes, you can take them.
I'll take it.
Absolutely.
Okay. No, thank you. No, thanks for the questions. I think on the first one, the scale up that has been significant since January has now reached a situation where we reached the 1 million beneficiaries in Khartoum, the entire state, and the seven localities. At the beginning of our scale-up, we could not reach all the seven localities. Since April, we can reach all the seven localities. I think that, for me, answered the first question. When we look at the depth of hunger, I think the area in the south, and I will just name one that's probably resonates, Jebel Awliya, is the one that was the last one held by RSF, and it's the last one that was pushed and where we now have access. The level of hunger and destitution and desperation that was found when the first distributions took place last month were severe and basically confirmed the risk of famine in those areas. But with the significant scale up, we are now doing everything to avert and to keep it at that and to mitigate any further deterioration. On the funding, we do receive, and I think I wanted to emphasize the generosity and the fact that despite receiving contribution, what is the key issue at the moment is the needs are literally outpacing the continuous generosity that we receive from donors. The $500 million that we are looking at, that was only the emergency food and cash assistance. In addition to that, we are deploying other programs, nutrition, we are deploying school feeding, we are deploying a number of other activities that are yet again above the 500 mark that I decided to flag here. So in between last month and this month, we did receive funding, but unfortunately not in the tune of 200 million. We still are short overall of actually more than 700 million when we consider all programs within our operation. We are hopeful and engaging with many donors and see and hope that the opportunities that we see, both with our access and with the returns of many Sudanese towards places like Khartoum or Wad Madani, will be matched and will be supported by an increase of contribution in the very near future to basically anchor the peace and anchor an element of stability. I think we cannot afford to have a return and fail the return after peace is there and access has been regained. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Laurent. Yes, Robin of AFP.
Thank you. Those people who are coming back to Khartoum, whereabouts are they coming from? And can you say a bit more about the sort of condition that they're in? Secondly, on Khartoum itself, are the conditions in the city conducive to doing the sort of operation that you would like to do there? And finally, if you could say a bit more about the famine in the south, just on in terms of the depths of the famine there. Thank you.
Okay, I'll go straight. Is that okay? So on the return, I think first and foremost, I think the IOM has a tracking on the displacement and on the return. The information that we have available at the moment is actually the first part of the year massive return has actually been in Jazeera State and with also numbers in Khartoum, but more are expected to come in Khartoum. So that's the first element there. The origin of the displaced at the moment that are returning and that have returned are more first internally within Sudan and are returning from various areas that were defined as the largest element of the displacement in Kassala, in Gedaref, and in Northern States. I don't have at this point the exact details of their specific origin, but as we track those returns, we will have that, and we will have to rebalance the assistance both at origin and at destination. In terms of the conditions, I think as I said in the aftermath of the return and the access to the further south location, and in particular Jebel Aliyah, the conditions were those that we were expecting, unfortunately, as the risk of famine had been declared. As we scaled up the assistance and continue to scale up with access, we hope that we can beat and keep it either at that or hopefully further away from a risk of famine.
Thanks again, Laurent. And of course, colleagues from some of our humanitarian agencies are connected should you have questions specifically for them, or if you want to chime in, please just raise your hands. Further questions for a colleague from WFP, either in the room or online? I don't see that's the case. Maybe just to remind you, colleagues, late Thursday, we issued a statement pertaining to these attacks that we just heard about on behalf of the Secretary General, in to which he naturally condemns in the strongest possible terms the attacks which took the lives of our colleagues, our humanitarian colleagues, and of course civilians who we aim to protect wherever and whenever we can. So I think on that note, we'll end it. And I'd like to thank you very, very much to you, Laurent, and to your team for doing the amazing work you do in the field. Thanks again. And please don't hesitate to join us here at this press briefing.
I think you have a hand up if I...
Sorry?
I think there is a hand up from...
Oh, yes. You're more attentive than I. You're more... yes, indeed. There's a hand that just popped up. Pardon me. Antonio of the Spanish News Agency has a question for you. Go ahead, Antonio.
Yes, sorry. I raised the hand a bit late.
No, that's okay.
And
go
my
ahead.
My question is in general for all the UN agencies, including WFP, because... we have witnessed the exit of Elon Musk from the U.S. government. He was the big advocate of cutting aid to the UN agencies. So I want to know if this is having already some effect on the UN system, or if you expect some effect in the future, some positive effect. Thank you.
Maybe Laurent, you can speak from your own experience on behalf of WFP. If anyone wants to jump in on that particular question, please feel free to do so. I can just maybe just in general comment, as we've said, we're always looking for forms of funding in kind. A lot of these agencies, as you know, are funded through voluntary contributions. Others, there are different mechanisms through which we do our work, but we need cash, we need funds, we need resources to provide vital services for those that we serve. So that's just a general comment, as we've been saying here repeatedly on every single different context where there's a conflict in particular. But maybe, Laurent, if you had anything you wanted to add on that note, maybe how it's affected the operations, maybe more generally on the operations in Sudan for the World Food Program.
No, thanks. No, I think it's an important question that certainly has had a focus over the last few months. So the first answer is that The US remain our largest donor, has been a very large contributor to Sudan, and despite a number of cuts in funding, the funding that we had received over last year has been preserved. We haven't lost part of that funding. It has remained with us, and we have been able to implement today thanks to that. We are, as you indicated, doing everything possible to, one, acknowledge the generous contribution from all, and to diversify and grow as much as possible the generosity for Sudan. I think it's important we all do that as a collective. My last point is, despite a lot of uncertainty, there is a significant focus, and we are hopeful to receive new support from the US. We are at advanced stage of engagement and hope to be receiving a renewed support in the operation in Sudan, both in terms of in-kind and hopefully also in the form of cash. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laurent. I am looking just to make sure I don't miss any other hands popping up, and I don't see that's the case. Checking in the room one last time. So that's, and thanks for that subsequent answer. I think that will do it. And again, please thank you firstly, and do join us here at this briefing whenever you can. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, colleagues, we have some announcements, starting with Sandra Bisson, who is a communication specialist with GIGA, who is going to brief about an exciting festival that's coming up, and then we'll go to our colleagues from ITU for another announcement. But Sandra, over to you first.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning. Today, more than 2.6 billion people around the world are still not connected to the internet. This makes the digital divide one of the defining equity challenges of our time. It is urgent, it is global, and it's impossible to ignore. And there's another sobering reality. Nearly half of the world's 6 million schools remain offline. As a result, some 500 million children and young people are being left behind, not just in terms of digital learning, but in the chance to connect, to grow, and to seize the opportunities of tomorrow's digital economy. On June 12th, the GIGA Photo Festival, organized around the theme The Joy of Connection, will hold its official inauguration and award ceremony at the Parc des Bastions in Geneva. In collaboration with the City of Geneva, this event is much more than a celebration of photography. It puts a human face on the digital divide and offers a powerful sense of hope. Above all, it reminds us all that solutions are not only possible, they are within our reach. So what is GIGA? GIGA is a partnership launched in 2019 by UNICEF and the International Telecommunication Union with a bold goal to connect every school on the planet to the internet and to give every young person access to the information, the skills, and the opportunities they need to shape their futures. Since it started, GIGA and its partners have mapped more than 2.1 million schools around the globe and helped bring better internet access to over 24,000 of them, benefiting nearly 11 million students. This is a global ambition made real to ensure that every child, wherever they live, can be connected to the world, can learn freely, and can dream without limits. The festival's photo competition featured three categories: single image, young visual storyteller, and multiple images. Each category invited photographers to tell powerful visual stories about how internet connectivity can transform lives. The winning entries, selected by a student jury from Head Geneve and professional judges, advocate for something we deeply believe in: the right to digital connectivity as a basic human right. On Thursday this week, we'll be proud to present 30 winning photographs chosen from over 3,400 entries across 89 countries. Among the winners is a photo series titled Acompañantes, documenting how, amid major legal shifts around abortion rights in Latin America and the US, a new generation of women and girls is turning to digital tools to build networks of care and solidarity. Other winning images showcase the powerful intersection between connectivity and major social and humanitarian issues, the human cost of migration, for instance, and how in exile, technology has become a vital lifeline. So a message to you and to the tiny or huge photographers community in Geneva is clear. Join us in Geneva on June 12th at the Parc des Bastions to experience the transformative power of internet connectivity seen through the lens of photographers, heard in the voices of children and youth, and reflected in a shared vision of a digital future where no child is left offline. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandra. This is an immensely important cause, and thank you for spotlighting it in such a creative way. So I'm sure colleagues will go down to the Parc des Bastions on this Thursday, the 12th, for this nice event. Do we have questions for Sandra before we move to our next subject? I don't see that's the case. I think you're abundantly clear. So see you on Thursday. Thanks very much. Last but certainly not least, we have our colleagues from the ITU. We have David with us, with Christina Boetti. But David, I think you wanted to start off and do a few preliminary remarks.
Maybe just a quick introduction, if I can. We'll be talking about, Christina will be talking about the second UN Virtual Worlds Day, which is a global gathering to see how AI-powered virtual worlds can address global change. The event takes place on over 2 days, the 11th and 12th of June in Turin, Italy, and will feature dialogues, interactive showcases, project presentations that explore the role of AI-powered virtual worlds in shaping the future of cities and governments, including the future of digital public infrastructure. Although in Turin, the event is open for participation both at the venue and online. We'll make sure to include the link in the briefing notes. And we also expect to have a release closer to the attached to the closing of that event that we hope to be able to provide to you under embargo. And here then to tell us more about the event, Christina Boetti, who is a study group counselor at ITU's Telecommunications Standardization Bureau.
Thank you, David, and good morning to all of you. Indeed, I'm delighted actually to share with you information on this multi-agency event. It is actually co-organized jointly by 19 UN entities, and it's really a UN flagship platform to explore how virtual worlds, artificial intelligence, and immersive technologies can really support public service deliverable, as well as also digital cooperation. It will bring together global leaders. We are going to have ministers, mayors, city representatives, academia, and private sector. And, you know, we are going to have 2 days of discussion that will help actually to explore the challenges and opportunities that these new technologies bring. But what are exactly virtual worlds? They are immersive and interactive digital environments, so spaces where people, systems, and intelligent technologies can come together to learn, collaborate, simulate complex scenarios, and provide services in real time. So these environments will really leverage a lot of enabling technologies such as artificial intelligence, you know, 3D technologies that can help us to visualize and interact with really complex systems in different ways. And let me be clear, this is not really science fiction. This is something that it is being already used and seen today. So indeed, actually, virtual worlds are being used in various practical ways, from, for example, in cities where they are creating AI-driven digital twins to model traffic and energy use. For example, humanitarian agencies are using immersive simulation to train peacekeepers in complex conflict zones. And schools are also using virtual classrooms to reach children, especially in remote or underserved areas. So I would say that this technology is really are here to help and improve public services, education, disaster response, and really that's why the United Nations, all 19 UN entities, we have been teaming up together and also working through the Global Initiative on AI and Virtual Worlds, which was launched actually last year during the first edition of the UN Virtual Worlds Day by the ITU, UNICC, and Digital Dubai. We will have really the opportunity to explore what these new technologies can bring. So at the event in Turin, we will be launching a new report. Participants, they will have the opportunity actually to experience interactive demos firsthand. So there will be really an exhibition open to everyone. That's an event which is indeed actually open to everyone, and you can also join online. We will also launch a series of new initiatives that will be specifically focused for developing countries, and the event is also expected to celebrate the participation of students. In particular, we will be celebrating the students team that won the first Cityverse challenge. So Cityverse is really the application of virtual worlds in cities, and we are going to have youth actually participating. You know, they are the change makers, so they will be the one that will be leading specifically discussion in a session. We will also have the opportunity to carry out a foresight exercise, so scenario thinking, envisaging what the world will look like in 5 years, all together in a collaborative way. And that's really why I really invite all of you to join us in Turin. It's not that far, but for those of you that will not be able to join us on site, join us online. We'll be happy, actually, to have also journalists contributing to this global gathering. Thank you.
Thanks to you both. And I'm sure, David, you'll share all the information on how one can connect. Of course, in person would be lovely in Turino. Sounds like a great youth engagement opportunity as well. So thanks very much for that. Do we have questions? Yes, we do. Gabriela Proceso has a question. Sorry, let me just mention, colleagues, I just received a text. We will have one additional item. UNHCR will brief Eugene, will brief momentarily on a global trends report. So do stay tuned for Eugene momentarily. But Gabby, is this a question for our ITU colleagues?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I would like to know if in the event you're going to have, do you hear me?
See, si, yes.
Hello?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay. Yes, if you're going to have a special event or something talking about the importance of communications in times of chaos, you know, and for example, now in Los Angeles, there is, you know, the migrants are being attacked and with the police in USA. And I heard that the government wants to cut the cellular phones and, you know, the cellular communications. So are you aware of this situation? What can the ITU can do in moments like this? Thank you so much.
Thank you for the question. I would say generally, as we've said here many times, generally we support the access, as you heard from our GIGA colleagues a little bit earlier, that there are 2.6 billion people in the world that do not have access, reliable access to communications, and there are 5.5 that do. And as a specialized agency or an information communication technology, we generally support that people have access to these devices. But beyond that, we don't don't have anything prescriptive that relates to any specific situation such as that you're referencing. So it's really about providing a platform for member states to come together to hopefully develop and provide the connectivity to the global community, and for a global community to be able to access these and to be able to have the skills and the capacity to use them.
Thank you, David. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, David. Thank you, Christina. May I proceed with my question if it's not related with the Torino Virtual Day, but related with standardization, which is the home territory of Christina? AI standardization, if I may.
The question is, sorry, who is the question pointed to?
Christina, about AI standardization.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Against the backdrop of the upcoming AI for Good Summit.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. So my question is, with regards to the upcoming AI for Good Summit, we have a AI standard day. Is it the first time we are having this AI standard day after the UN had the governing AI for humanity report published last September? Or is this the first time we have the AI standard day, or the second one after last year you had a daily one, these different categories? And in view of the substances of the standardization of the standards, as I'm reading from the governing AI for humanity report, it says now there is a proliferation of AI standards reaching to a number of 117 AI-related standards registered with the IETU, ISO, and IEEE. So what you plan to do, whether in this AI for Good Summit or in some upcoming instances, to streamline this standards, this spaghetti of standards? Thank you.
Yeah, there's a level of specificity to the question that I don't have the precise answer to for you right now, but we'll try to get that for you. There was work on this that took place at the ITU's one of its statutory conferences, which was the World Telecommunications Standardization Assembly, which took place in New Delhi back in November, if I'm correct. And so there was some meetings on standardization that took place there related to this, and there'll be meetings here, and there'll certainly be meetings that go forward from there. But as far as the technical specificity on that, we'll get that to you. We also, I should mention, as we get closer to the summit, we'll have representatives from the Bureau who are the Telecommunication Standardization Bureau, who are very closely connected to that program, more so than Christina might be, or myself, to brief on that. So I would suggest for the moment, if it's okay, that we'll make sure that they're here and available to answer those questions. But we can be back in touch to specifically get to your question.
Okay, thank you very much. In the room, no, I think Gabby, is that a follow-up for ITU?
Yes, thank you, Rolando. No, my question is for you.
Okay, before we move to me, I don't want to be selfish here, but let's move on. Just make sure we have no further comments for our colleagues. And we also have, if you don't mind holding your question to the end for me, because we do have Eugene from UNHCR who's waiting for an important update, as I mentioned, just came in. So beforehand, I'd just like to thank you both, Christina and David, as always, for joining us here. And good luck in Torino tomorrow and the next day. Yes, please hold on to that question, Gabby. So Eugene from UNHCR has an announcement, I believe, on the Global Trends Report from the UN Refugee Agency. Eugene, over to you.
Hi, everyone. So as you are waiting for our Global Trends Report 2024, that we will share the link where you can find the advanced copy and press release and photo set and B-roll, social media asset, everything, we will send it today. This is UNHCR's flagship annual report, which include the figure of forced displacement across the world. So as many of you followed every year, that most of the data set are for 2024, but the main figure will include the data up to April 2025. So this year, unfortunately, we're not offering the High Commissioner's media briefing because he's traveling this week. But please contact one of us if you would like to do the interview with the High Commissioner, as well as other senior management, including Assistant High Commissioner and Director. Please contact one of us so we can arrange an interview for the Global Trends Report, as well as ahead of World Refugee Day. So that's it from our side. Thanks, Rolando.
Thanks to you, Eugene. I think that was very clear, and we'll look out for that information. So I don't see any questions specifically on this subject for you. So thanks again for jumping in on that important announcement. Okay, Gabby, I do have a few announcements, but maybe I'll just take your question first, and then I'll get to those announcements after. Go ahead, Gabby.
Yes, thank you very much, Rolando. I just wanted to ask UNHCR, what is the procedure to ask for the interview? We email you or
you can contact Matt.
Okay.
Yeah, then we can arrange for who is possible. We cannot offer High Commissioner for everyone, but we will see that his schedule, and then we will contact you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
The question for you, Rolando, is if Secretary General did a statement or say something on the situation in Los Angeles.
Listen, let me just start off by saying this is among my announcements. The Secretary General is currently giving a press conference in Nice. It may be finished by now. I'm not sure if he addressed this specific subject, but as you know, we're all watching what's happening in L.A. and Los Angeles. Of course, we hope that everyone will de-escalate this situation. And you know, the spokesperson of the Secretary General yesterday echoed just that. Certainly hope that all parties do de-escalate situation, and we don't want any further escalation of the situation on the ground. And we hope that the local, state, and federal levels work towards that goal. So that's what I can say on behalf of the situation in Los Angeles. So let me just go on to a few short announcements. As mentioned, the Secretary General is in Nice, and his press conference may very well have wrapped up by now. But whilst in Nice yesterday, he was at the opening of the UN Ocean Conference, as you well know, which got underway. And the SG's remarks, we did share those with you. Among other things, he said that although the sea has sustained life for millennia, we are failing to protect the ocean thanks to overfishing, plastic pollution, and rising temperatures, excuse me. He urged countries that have not yet ratified the Agreement on Marine Biological Diversity of Areas beyond national jurisdiction to do so. And then he also issued a strong call to all countries to agree on an ambitious and legally binding treaty on plastic pollution this year. Now, I should mention that we do have a big gathering here taking place in Geneva in August from the 5th to the 14th of August. We have a big intergovernmental negotiating commission meeting to discuss this pollution treaty. So a very, very important gathering. Of course, our colleagues from UNEP and ourselves, we will be sharing more details on how you can follow that important gathering. The SG, whilst in Nice, he also addressed an Africa for the Ocean event. He met with members of civil society, held a number of bilateral meetings, the readouts of which we've shared with you. So do take a look at those emails. Very quickly, we also wanted to flag the statement that we did share with you last night concerning Colombia. The Secretary General strongly condemns the attempt on the life of Miguel Uribe Turbe, who is a Colombian presidential candidate, in Bogota on the 7th of June, this past Saturday. And of course, the Secretary General hopes for a full recovery of Mr. Turbe and expresses solidarity with his family and the Colombian people. That's in the statement we shared with you yesterday. Three more quick announcements in terms of human rights treaty bodies and no treaty bodies meeting this week. And in terms of the Conference on Disarmament, we're still waiting for the dates for the next session to be announced, and we'll do that. We'll share that with you as soon as we're aware. Press conferences in this chair tomorrow will be Ambassador Jörg Lauber, who is the president of the UN Human Rights Council, also permanent representative of Switzerland. And he will be briefing you on the upcoming 59th regular session of the Human Rights Council, taking place from the 16th of June, that's this coming Monday, to the 9th of July. So be here at 1:45 tomorrow, the 11th of June, for that encounter with Ambassador Lauber, the president of the Human Rights Council. And last but not least, just an observance for you, a video message for the Secretary General, which notes, speaking to the International Day for Dialogue Among Civilizations, which is today. And this is the first ever International Day for Dialogue Among Civilizations. Among other things, the Secretary General, Mr. Guterres, says today that mission is more urgent than ever, dialogue among civilizations, that is. He calls that, he says, where dialogue is missing, ignorance fills the void. Very important message there. Let's answer hate with humanity. Let's listen with open hearts and open minds, and let's choose dialogue over division, which is indeed our mission at these United Nations. So thanks for taking a look at that message. Do we have any questions for me online or in the room? I don't see that's the case. So on that note, I'd like to wish you a good afternoon. See you here on Friday.